Brother Mike. Thank you, Elizabeth, Sister Elizabeth. Excellent choice of hymns. Couldn't have done better, for sure. This evening is a sort of a continuation of what we looked at a few months ago. I think it was about 6 months ago we started to look at the topic, the Bible in emotion. I don't know if it's a topic we've ever looked at before, at least not that I can remember. But it's actually this chapter that caused me to think a little bit about it. And unfortunately for me, I can't stop thinking about these things at times. And this is a particular one of these things that I just had to understand a little bit better, because I really can't say as I understood clearly what Paul was trying to get at when he tried to explain the struggle that goes on within him. So in order to do that, because it's been 6 months, we're going to do a bit of a review just to sort of set the stage again. And then we'll go into the first emotion that we want to have a look at tonight, which is fear. So we'll start out by looking at these things. Where do our sins come from? How are emotions formed? How our senses process that information? The source of our emotions, the purpose of our emotions, because I think they have a purpose, and the process that leads to sin and the cycle of sin. And then we'll kind of look at fear itself, and then really get into the emotion that we have called fear. So if we just go back to Romans, if you want to open your Bible for a minute, just looking at those last few verses, and when you read them really carefully from verses 15 on, he says, Paul says, "For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not, but what I hate, that I do." I think everybody can understand this. I mean, when I think of scriptural characters of the Bible, men and women of the Bible who you consider faithful, I would say there are few who are considered more faithful, more godly in their character than the Apostle Paul. And yet when you read these verses, you get the impression that there's this massive struggle going on in Paul. We don't always see it coming out in the things he does, but it's obviously something that he wrestled with. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, it's something I wrestle with, not just once in a while, but this is a daily battle that we wage, that there is a struggle that is going on within our bodies, in our minds. "If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For the will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do." I just can't relate that to Paul easily. It doesn't seem like him, not from what we read. "Now if I do that I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. I find in a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me, for I delight in the law of God after the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members." So that's kind of the verse that sets the context for all of this. This idea that there is a law of sin and a law of the Spirit almost that are opposing each other. And Paul talks about this in the most graphic terms, that it causes us to really start to understand it a little better. And last time when we looked at this a bit more detail, we noted that there is a law in our members which we understand to be sin nature, essentially, the law of sin. We know that it's in opposition to the law of the Spirit, the law of God, essentially. But it doesn't really tell us a lot about how it all works out. There's something a little bit missing there. He tells us what's happening, essentially. But we don't really know a lot about the details. And most importantly, how we can dampen or even stop that from happening, if that's possible. And so we started to talk about our senses, which actually provide input into our minds, essentially, in our bodies. If you think a little bit about it, I like to, one little analogy I came up with is, most of us are car owners or have cars or drive them. If you take the car into the garage, you notice one day that the tires are really wearing on one side. So you can go in and get them replaced, and that fixes the problem. temporarily. But there may be an underlying problem that's really causing the tires to wear on one side. And of course, you know, if you've had a car, that usually the tires are out of alignment, the car's out of alignment. And the mechanic hopefully will point that out to you before he sends you off with another set of tires, which wear out very rapidly, and you have to get them replaced again. So there is an underlying process that's going on that needs to be identified so that you can get the problem fixed and you don't have to replace your tires as often. So that's not a very good example, but it just shows the underlying issue that you can't just deal with the worn tires without understanding why they're getting worn so that you can do something about it. At least understanding something is a lot easier when you appreciate why it happens. Then you can work on it then. So talking about senses like our sight, our hearing, our touch, and that sort of thing, those senses that hopefully we all have, it led us to think along the lines that that actually helped to precipitate emotion. So seeing things and hearing things and touching things actually causes us to become emotional about certain things. And there's a process that actually started to happen. It's sort of what we've already looked at, essentially. And we cause to think a little bit about emotions. Are they good or are they bad? I mean, we're looking tonight at fear. Is the emotion fear a good emotion or a bad emotion? Is the emotion love a good emotion or a bad emotion? Or sadness or hate or envy or all these things that make up these complex creatures that we are, essentially. And we also learned, I think, that as a result of our emotions, we are much more prone to weakness and sin. So on one hand, we're blessed to have senses that allow us to sense the world around us, the environment, but it precipitates emotions which often get us into trouble and causes great problems. So the emotions are a result of the information that we take in. Whether we're being told about something, whether we're experiencing something ourselves, etc., etc. Senses are kind of like raw data. Of themselves, they are completely benign. There's nothing wrong with being able to see. There's nothing wrong with hearing. Absolutely. God gave us those senses to be able to perceive what's going on around us. What happens when we start to process the things that we're seeing and hearing is when things start to go wrong sometimes. So it seemed to me that when we're born, we're little babies essentially, we come out of the chute as a few babies are coming right now, and they're absolutely clean slates. They have senses, but they have no emotions to speak of. Almost immediately they start to learn emotions, essentially. And me in particular, have decided that all of our emotions are learned for the most part. When we're born, we are clean slates, essentially. And the emotions that we gain, and to whatever degree we gain them, are learned. And that's important to understand, I think, that when we're born, we're basically a clean slate. So, for example, when we're very young, our mom and dad tell us, don't touch the stove, it's hot. That's a bit of information. Be careful going down the stairs, you could trip. All bits of useful information. Of course, we don't often understand what hot is until we touch the stove or fall down the stairs. And then we start to appreciate what that is. So touching the stove is bad, it hurts, and it creates emotions in us. So we start to learn those sorts of things. So emotions are formed from a process, and we kind of looked at the idea of a weather station. Don't know if that was the most appropriate example, but basically emotions are evolved from senses, essentially, as we've already said. It's just raw data. It comes into our minds and our bodies. I'm seeing you all now. I mean, there's nothing particularly important one way or the other about looking at you. But when I look at you now, because I know you, there's emotions rise up. You know, I have a lot of affection for all of you. So, you know, there's things that start to come into play just by the seeing of you. Or, you know, if you suddenly throw something at you, that will raise another emotion all of a sudden. You know, if out of the blue you trip me as I go up the aisle, that will cause me to think about that and react, and it raises emotions. So the actual data that's coming in is raw data. It's not until it gets into our minds and our bodies that we start to process it. And our bodies, even when they're very little, start to process that raw data. And it becomes not just mental, but it becomes physical as well. So the idea that the stove is hot, we start to have a kind of a healthy fear of the stove. We're going to be much more careful being around the stove if we've touched it a couple of times and burnt ourselves, because we know it hurts. There's a physical pain that goes along with it. And just the opposite of that is physical pleasures as well. When we have something that we really like, it causes us to tend to want to gravitate towards that. And it gets reinforced more and more. So our minds help process that, and it becomes a very physical kind of thing. So there's the five senses, essentially. And really what we get is this idea of the little girl, essentially, who senses something, got an ice cream cone, maybe the first one she's ever had, has no idea what it's like. She may have been told that it's really tasty, but until she tastes it for the first time, she has no idea whether she's actually going to like it or not, which is part physical and part mental. So she senses something, there's a physical response, hey, that's good, I like that, that's kind of nice. There's an emotion which is created, which is like. Like is an emotion. And it causes us to want more. So the next time we drive past Dairy Queen, she wants to stop for an ice cream, or he wants to stop for an ice cream. And it starts to form a habit and a cycle. And that habit, as we know, gets reinforced, and it gets stronger and stronger. So we have these five senses that are providing us with data. In itself, seeing the ice cream isn't really all that important. But because we've tasted it before and it's pleasurable, when we see it, we start to get excited about it because we like the ice cream. You know, it's a kind of a positive reinforcement. And there's a distinctive process, I think, that we all go through when we're presented with things around us. Now, we are very complex creatures, and we're being presented with thousands of bits of data all the time. When you go for a walk, when you drive your car and see things, you're being inundated with thousands of little bits of data, and your mind is processing all of that data. I kind of think that's how it works. Our noses smell smells, our eyes see sight, our fingers touch things, our tongues taste, and our ears hear. It's what happens after these things, after this information gets into our minds and body, that the process happens. Now, it's interesting. Our senses provide us with the information, and our bodies process that information, and there's a kind of a feedback. In fact, I think Brother Thomas called this idea of the senses a sensorium. I think it's in Elpis Israel or Eureka. He talks quite a bit about this whole process of the sensorium, where the senses are so critical on defining who we are, that information about what we're smelling or seeing or touching or tasting or hearing. It's a very physical process to begin with, seeing things or touching them, etc. And I think all of us, when you actually start to think of it, understand how it works. You know, you can see it yourself. And we kind of looked at this, the example of the young girl or the boy tasting ice cream for the first time. In all likelihood, when she actually tries that ice cream for the first time, there's going to be lots of things happening. It's not just seeing the ice cream that reinforces this to her. It's pleasant to taste, so there's the sense of taste. It smells good in all likelihood. I don't think she'd like it if it smelled like rotten cabbages or something, but tasted okay. It looks inviting, and she may even enjoy the feel of it against her lips and her mouth on a hot summer day. So right there you have at least four out of the five senses that are telling her and reinforcing her that this is really good, that I like this. It's a pleasurable experience. And she learns very quickly that she finds it physically pleasurable and she wants more. She doesn't really think about it. Nobody ever stops to think about what's happening too much. But that's really the kind of process that's going on. And it's a cycle that's easy to see. And it starts to become reinforced the more that it happens. Now, we kind of illustrated this a little bit with this idea of the two babies. I don't know if you remember this or not, but babies and lemons and babies and mangoes. If you give babies lemons, in all likelihood, they're not going to enjoy them all that much, partly based on that picture. If you give babies mangoes, they're probably going to like them a lot because they're sweet and they're tasty. And in all likelihood, the baby with the mango is going to want that particular food again. The baby with the lemon will probably run screaming in the other direction when you try and feed it again that same lemon. So we obviously are defined partly by the information that's coming in. And so the baby on the right learns to like, which is an emotion. The baby on the left learns to dislike, which is the opposite of that. So it almost sounds like in some cases we were a little bit unclear as to whether senses are good and bad. I don't think they're necessarily good or bad. They're kind of benign. Actually, senses help us to feel things. They help us to create emotions. In and of themselves, they're just data gathering sensors, essentially. They help us perceive what's going on around us. So our emotions, too, as an extension of the senses, can be good or bad as well. Being able to like something, I come to like you and eventually love you because we get to know each other. That's a positive thing. We come to love God because of what he's done for us, that sort of thing. Our emotions and the reaction to our senses help to shape us. It makes us who we are, essentially. Our emotions really do that. Emotions are useful in a way because they help imbue situations with meaning. In other words, if you suddenly go, "Ah," at me, I know that you're surprised about something. You know, it helps me understand what you're feeling, perhaps. And if you didn't have any emotions, you'd be a robot. That's the long and short of it, I think. If we had no emotions, we would not be able to feel anything, really. So what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch shapes our experiences. It helps us to learn to love, which can be very good, but it also helps us to fear and to hate and to envy and to be jealous and to pity and so forth. In fact, all the emotions that we have, whether negative or positive, come from what we're taking into us through our senses. So, in fact, if you by extension look at that, if you look at all of our emotions, you see that many of them are negative because we tend to dwell upon things that are important to us specifically. And they tend to be negative because they're based on our senses of what we're taking in physically. I mean, just because we like the ice cream doesn't mean that that's necessarily a positive thing to do when you think about it a little bit. So emotions are important. Without emotions, we probably never sin because we never feel anything. We'd be like robots. Without them, we would never feel. They are both good and bad. Unfortunately, the bad for us far outweigh the good. And that's the sad fact of it. So we ask the question, what would it be like if we never were born with senses? Well, that's the outcome, essentially. If we never were born with senses, we would be robots, and we would not be able to feel anything. Emotions, as we said, give situations meaning. Emotions are critical to learning and memory. Emotions help us to relate to each other. It's the essence of body language. You can tell if somebody's upset or angry or happy or sad or things like that. If you never knew anybody was sad, by looking at them, you'd never be able to help them, hardly. Sometimes emotions can be quite useful to help us. They give meaning to our lives. But they have a dark side as well. And understanding that process is important to being able to see kind of what the dark side is. What they're not good for is what happens when they take a tangent, I guess. So emotions can lead us to sin, which is exactly what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 7. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life from Genesis 3 and 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16. Emotions are the things, I believe, that actually lead us to sin and cause us to do things that intellectually we might not do. We can intellectualize something. It'd be very easy to not sin if you didn't have any emotions. But because you have emotions, and sometimes very strong ones, it often leads us to sin. So it's really important in understanding that. So the process that I think Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 7, when he talks about this law of sin in his members, this struggle that's going on within him, it's kind of like this, I think. Eve saw the fruit, and that eventually became the lust of the flesh. She desired it. There was something about it that she wanted. It became an emotional response. It was pleasant to the eyes. These are all senses that are working upon our minds and our bodies to desire something. And it became the lust of the eyes. The tree was desired to make one wise, and it became the pride of life. So there is a distinct process that goes on that helps us understand that a little bit. The process is a subtle one. And you don't even know it's happening sometimes. Until it's too late, you suddenly think, why did I react that way? What caused me to do that? You know, to get angry at the guy in front of me and who slammed on his brakes and cut me off or something. What is it that causes us to do that? Not just see it sort of, oh well, he cut me off, but no harm done, we're both okay. You could think of it very unemotionally. But oftentimes, we are subject to our emotions. So our senses provide us with the data about what is around us. Our bodies react to what is pleasurable and what is not, what is unpleasant. That's the two big, broad categories that define why we do things oftentimes. Our emotions kindle our passions. Our minds shape our behavior, which ultimately leads us to sin and transgression. Now, I know that's not as detailed as it could be, but I think it's important to understand the process. So we have this whole sort of cycle that happens, I think, when something new is introduced to us, like the girl with the ice cream, that process that turns from just seeing it and looking at it and tasting it to, wow, this is really great, I love this stuff, and I got to have more of it. It's if you take it a step further, it can become a problem almost. It's not just a matter of liking the taste of ice cream. It's what the world around us is directing us every single day. You can't turn on a television or read a magazine without somebody appealing to your emotions to either get you to buy a new car or to, get a bigger house or whatever it may be. We are being bombarded. And they know exactly how to appeal to our basis instincts, which is our emotions. So you see the shiny new car. You happen to be driving a dilapidated old one right now, but I see somebody zipping by in a brand new one and think, that looks pretty snazzy to me, and it sounds cool. And you start to think, well, I'm a little bit envious of that person. I mean, you can intellectualize it and say, who cares, one way or another, but we do this. And it's easy to see how it turns from a sort of a basic envy to a covetousness, which is starting to become a serious sin, which maybe even becomes, that person really bugs me. I'm starting to hate them because they have that cool car and I have this old jalopy. It can go that far and sometimes does go that far, unfortunately. So understanding that is important to being able to maybe stop it or to prevent it from going any further. It's a difficult cycle, and I find, I don't know about you, but I find it's a hard cycle to break sometimes. If you reinforce something over and over and over again, it's like when I became a diabetic. I loved Slurpees and slushes and sweet things in general. Actually breaking the habit of having that every day is very hard because I really like that stuff. You get into kind of a rut, like that big rut in this muddy road. Because in many ways, our emotions or our passions can rule us and often do rule us. On an intellectual basis, it's kind of easy to intellectualize or rationalize something. But it's much harder when we're presented with it. And somebody says, well, just have a taste. What's the harm in that? You know you shouldn't have it, but you think, boy, it tastes so good. You know, so I'm just going to have a little one this time. So it is hard to break that cycle. Habits are very hard to break. And habits are there because we are emotionally attached to something, whatever that may be, whether it's the ice cream or the new car or whatever. Everybody struggles with this, I think. I can't be the only one, surely to goodness, that struggles with this issue. I see Paul struggling with it. He certainly understood it. I delight in the law of God after the inward man. It's not hard for me to understand that the Bible is magnificent. It's wonderful. It's the way we should all live by. Actually going out of the door tonight and living that, though, are two different things, because I can intellectualize this all I want and I can tell you how to live, but I know myself I'm going to struggle with it each and every day with certain aspects of my emotions, essentially, with what's driving me to do the things I do. I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. I think Paul understood that really well. It's the case with all of our emotions. It's hard to moderate or be balanced at anything. We want to do things, but oftentimes we're battling against ourselves. It's a really difficult subject. So we're going to have a look at fear tonight. I'm sorry it took me that long to get into it. We'll race through the rest of it for the most part. We want to consider fear as an emotion for the few minutes. And I think fear is a good one, for me in particular, because it's something I've always struggled with. Fear is one of the first emotions we learn as babies and as young children, and I think we all know and understand the effects of fear. Interestingly, emotions can be everything from things that are in our mind, sort of psychological things, I fear that, to physiological things. You know, when you have a deep fear, I mean a really serious fear of something, it can be debilitating, absolutely debilitating, both physically and mentally. So I've got this kind of chart which shows that all of our emotions, I think, if you were to sort of categorize them into broad areas like love and hate and sadness and fear and envy, there's degrees of emotion as well. So fear is sort of a broad category for a whole range of emotions, essentially. So we're going to briefly look at what fear is. Why do we fear? Is it positive or negative or both? What fear leads to? Why do we worry, get stressed, become anxious? It's debilitating, and how do we overcome it? So according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the definition of fear is an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger and accompanied by increased autonomic activity, which basically means it's both mental and physical. When fear becomes significant, we start to feel it both physically and emotionally, in our minds, essentially. It becomes all-consuming. When we talked about this last time, we talked about the fact that there are degrees of fear. So I'm using fear in the terms of a broad sort of a category of a particular type of emotion. So if we were going to really classify fear as an emotion, there are degrees of intensity of fear, I think. And we'll kind of look at this very briefly. So tiny little fear is concern. So I have a concern over something. There's the definition of concern is very mild, little mental or physical effort, and is usually short-term. Sort of I'm leaving work and I'm kind of concerned that the traffic might be a bit heavy on the way home. No big deal. I'm not really worried about it. I just hope that it's not bad so I don't get stuck in traffic for half an hour. Worry, on the other hand, is concern which is starting to affect us. It affects us mentally. So I am worried about the upcoming test or the Bible class I have to do. That you, as long as you're not armed with overripe fruits and vegetables, I hope I'm okay towards the end of this. But, you know, it starts to affect you a little bit. Enough so that I'm starting to have trouble concentrating about what it is I need to do. It starts to become both a mental and a physical thing. So anxiety, on the other hand, is greatly increased worry. And it's much stronger. We start to get headaches and we start to get stomach aches. You can't think straight anymore. You can't think about anything else. If you are anxious about something, and I think all of us can speak from some experience, if something is causing you anxiety, and that's sort of high up on that scale there, it starts to become all-consuming. You really can't concentrate on much else. And I don't know about you, but that's the way it works with me. You can't really focus on anything. It's starting to affect you physically. It can be even a sense of foreboding, you know, towards dread. And then, of course, you have the red right at the top, and that's sort of all-consuming terror. And when somebody is terrified in that sense, there is nothing else they can think about. It is absolutely all-consuming and completely debilitating. It usually involves shaking uncontrollably, sweating, screaming, crying. It has even resulted, people who are really terrified have had heart attacks, or they become unconscious, that kind of thing. This is really super, super serious. And you can sort of see the intensity of fear, starting at sort of little fears and concern, going all the way up to being absolutely terrified. And I would be surprised if most of us haven't experienced that entire range at some point or another. Whether it's, you know, one of your kids gets injured suddenly and you're faced with what's happened to them, you know, whatever it might be. We've experienced up to probably the level of terror. Hopefully not very often. But you can see what happens in this process. If it's left uncontrolled or unchecked, I call this the fearometer, or if you want to call it that. There's sort of a gauge for every broad category of fear. So concern leads to worry, which leads to anxiety, which can lead to dread or terror if it gets really out of control. As the degree of fear increases, the more it affects us physically and mentally. The greater the fear, the less rational and thoughtful we become. In fact, we lose all sense of anything anymore. We become completely irrational. And you know yourself, if you are really getting close to the top of the fearometer there, you're not thinking about anything else. If it gets physical where you're shaking and can't concentrate for whatever reason, and hopefully that doesn't happen very often, but you actually start to lose hope in that case, and you start to lose faith. You can even lose your minds. I mean, lots of people are in psych wards of hospitals because fear of something has overwhelmed them so much, they have completely lost their minds. I mean, you may or may not have known people who have experienced that, but it can get that bad. And so it can become a debilitating thing. It's a progression which can go from a tiny fear to a great fear, and it can become an absolute phobia of something. And getting over fears that we have cultivated, something that we've reinforced over and over again, is not easily done. In fact, it might never be dispelled, actually. So I'll give you a tiny example, one of my many things that I have to deal with. I know when I was young, my dad, I wasn't in the truth, my parents, my grandparents were but I wasn't raised a Christadelphian, and my dad used to love horror movies, absolutely love them. And so when I was a fairly young child, we'd watch all night horror movies, and because that was his passion, but it caused me to have a real fear of the dark, I think. It kind of creeped me out. And, you know, now, even today, even though I understand absolutely clearly that there is really nothing to fear, it's just an absence of light, essentially, but if you told me to walk through that dark and scary forest, scary-looking forest, in the middle of the night, I would probably be subject to sort of a degree of fear, for sure. Not knowing why, really. I know that none of that stuff exists. But it still creeps back in because it was reinforced so much when I was young. It's irrational, completely irrational. I have really nothing to fear. I can't see anything, and I understand it's silly intellectually, but sometimes that fear raises itself again. And I think a lot of the things that we learned or understood when we were young cause us to carry that through into adulthood. And it can really upset us. Now, you probably can't see that, but for those of you who have a slight degree of arachnophobia, that would freak me out, I think. Pardon to use a colloquialism, but I would not like to have a spider on my neck, and I wouldn't like to have one pop down in front of me. I've got a little bit of a fear of spiders. It's not debilitating, but I can't say as I care for them all that much. Some people, it would completely incapacitate them to have that happen to them. They would not be able to function. So it's just kind of interesting what fear can do to us. And I guess that's what the crux of this. Fear can be real or it can be imaginary. And you can experience it because of a misconception or a misjudgment of a situation. It causes you to feel concerned, worry, anxious, and insecure, and gives you a complete lack of a positive feeling. It can get that way. I don't have to tell you any of this because I'm sure most people know this. There's a tendency to become hesitant or to procrastinate. You're not able to act or think sensibly or logically if the fear-o-meter goes right up. Fear imposes limitations upon your potential and your ability, and in the process can even ruin relationships and associations with other people. If they get so bad, like people who have a fear of leaving the house, I mean, what does that do to your relationships? If you can't even walk outside anymore because you have, what is it, agoraphobia or whatever it is? People have these things. Short-term fear is manageable, but long-term fears become ingrained and habitual, much like fears of spiders or snakes or dark or whatever it may be. As the intensity of our fears become greater, or the degree of fear rises on the old fearometer, it starts to become debilitating to us. And we can, in fact, cause us to react and do things that we would not otherwise be prone to. When you start to really fear something, you can do things that you would never otherwise do. You could see how that could easily happen. People react adversely, badly, in certain situations because of fear. And it can be for any number of reasons. So I guess what that's really leading to, all of that discussion is really leading to, is fear a lack of faith or trust in God? We know that the fear of God, I think Jeff talked about this the other day. I wasn't here, but I spoke to him. The fear of God is a good thing, but that's a different kind of fear, I think, than the fear we're talking about tonight. We know that the fear of God is not because we're afraid God is going to strike us with a lightning bolt or something. We have a respect for God. We often call it a reverential awe. And it's not based because we think God is going to strike us down. It's because we love God and we have respect for God because he's been compassionate towards us. That's not the same fear as possibly my fear of the dark or somebody else's fear of spiders or whatever that may be. That's a fear because you fear something, the consequences of something. So there's two kinds of fear: the reverential fear of God and being fearful about things, situations, and so forth. What does God require of us? Deuteronomy says, "And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good." So it's easy to see how reverencing God or fearing God should be encouraged. However, the second type of fear mentioned in the Bible isn't beneficial at all. If you turn briefly over to 2 Timothy, sorry, I've tried to put most of this on the overhead, but this one I don't have. to 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verses 6 and 7. Paul says to Timothy, "Wherefore I put thee in remembrance that thou stir up the gift of God which is in thee by the putting on of my hands. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." So God did not give us the fears that we have, which is important to understand. It's the same kind of fear that first appeared when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. They had never known fear in that sense before. They had certainly loved and reverenced God. But all of a sudden, they were afraid of the consequences of disobeying God. And that's a completely different fear. Sometimes when we are afraid, the spirit of fear overcomes us, and it's because we're frail, we're weak, our emotions get the better of us. We are afraid oftentimes for a whole range of things. You could list them all night long. Financial concerns, health concerns, fear for our loved ones, what might happen to them or what might not happen to them. Spiders or the dark or whatever it is. There's a whole range of them that everybody has from time to time, to one degree or another. It's a problem. But worse, sometimes you can dwell on them, and it can start to eat away at your faith. And it can sometimes cause you to question God. I know sometimes when I become completely debilitated by, why me? Why is this happening to me? Why is this particular issue happening to me? And the more you dwell upon that, the more you begin to question God. Why is God letting this happen to me? Doesn't he like me, or doesn't he care for me? And that can eventually lead to people losing their faith entirely. Like, why is God doing this to us? It becomes a fear of doubts that gets stronger and stronger. So it's really important to understand that that somehow has to be stopped before it becomes worse. We may say to ourselves, why is this happening to me? Or why doesn't God do something about this? Doesn't he understand how afraid I am of the consequences of this? You start to question in your own mind, your own faith. Well, obviously, I don't have to tell you that, of course, God knows that. And if you really start to think about it, not just feel it, but think about it, you do what Paul does. I know that there's this war going on in my mind. I have all these fears and things that are causing me to maybe question my faith a bit. But I also know that God is there. And no matter what may be happening to me, God is in control. He absolutely knows what our problems is. And you just have to keep telling you that. He knows your trials. He knows our problems, and particularly our fears. But fears can cause us to lose faith. They really can. And to question God, to question our reliance and trust in God. And it really means we have to put our faith and trust in God. Is fear a lack of faith? This kind of fear? Well, John says there is no fear in love. And he's talking not about the reverential fear, about the fear of things. But perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. No one's perfect. Obviously, God knows that. That is why he has liberally sprinkled encouragement against fear throughout the Bible, right from Genesis to Revelation. Beginning in Genesis and continuing through the book of Revelation, God reminds us to fear not. Put our trust in him. Trust me. Come to me. Bring your problems to me. It's not easy to do, but there are things we can do to help. If you look at another translation of the same verse, Weymouth says, "Love has in it no element of fear, but perfect love drives away fear, because fear involves pain." Remember the two sides to us, the pleasure and the pain? That's really, we're kind of two-sided in a way. We like pleasure, we don't like pain. Fear involves pain in some way, shape, or form, whether it's mental or physical. And if a man gives way to fear, there is something imperfect in his love. Well, God knows that we're imperfect. And he understands that very well. And he knows that we are so frail that These things can act upon us. That's why he's given us so many opportunities to come before him. And there are things that we can do that can actually help to, would you say, ameliorate fear or drive fear away. We can talk to people, certainly talk to our spouse, our family, our brethren and sisters in particular. We can always look for answers in the Word of God. That's where we should be looking for answers. We can take our fears and worries to God, because certainly if there's no other thing we can do, we can certainly appeal to God. And most importantly, we have to do this on a regular basis. It can't just be done once a week when we come to memorial meeting. It has to be done every day. In fact, the exact opposite of what fears cause us to do, which is it becomes habit-forming almost, to be fearful of things, God says, you have to make me habit-forming, essentially, which is a very difficult thing to do. God has to be habit-forming. We have to be going to God on a regular basis. Isaiah 41:10 says, do not fear, I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. We fear so many things. I hope you're better off than I am, because my little fears and concerns on the fearometer sort of go up and down all day long about a lot of things. Way too many things, I think. We fear the future. What's going to happen next week? Or what's going to happen to our kids? Or are we going to be able to get through this financial situation? Or whatever it may be. They keep coming at us all the time. The key, I think, which is what Paul is trying to tell us in Romans chapter 7, is we have to offset that by thinking about the fact that God is on our side. Like, he really does want us to be in the kingdom, and he really does care for us. And that has to be at the forefront of our mind as much as possible. Christ said, don't be afraid, you are worth more than many sparrows. So obviously, we're important to God. And in just those few verses, it covers so many different types of fear. God tells us not to be afraid of being alone. He tells us of not being too weak, of not being heard, of lacking physical necessities. All these admonitions to us are to put our trust in God. It's a spirit of fear, essentially. And we need to always remember the law of the Spirit can prevail over the spirit of fear, or the law in our members. So what Paul was talking about in Romans chapter 7 was this struggle that he endured, this law in his members, which I think relates to these strong emotions which were pulling him away sometimes. Maybe the doubts he had, or the concerns, or even rising to worry and anxiety about himself or his brethren and sisters, or whether he's even going to be able to eat or endure the next beating or whatever it may be. He obviously struggled with them. We obviously know he overcame them, though, because of one reason. He put his trust in God. That's really what it boils down to. The exhortation is, the only answer to all of our fears is to put our trust and confidence in God. Now, I did put down the very last slide here, examples of fear and faith. Two or three notable examples of a contrast between somebody who's fearing and somebody who's faithful. We read about Daniel and Darius the other day, last week, I think, where Daniel, with absolute confidence, went into the lion's den. Most of us would be shaking, crying, fighting, don't throw me into the lion's den. I'm not really looking forward to being torn to ribbons. Darius obviously was afraid for Daniel. He had a huge fear. He woke up, he was up all night shaking and trembling and weeping for Daniel, because he didn't have trust in Daniel's God. You look at the example of Christ and Peter. Christ going before the priests and the elders, and what he was going to face, knowing what he was going to face. And Peter in absolute fear, because his faith hadn't been consolidated yet. David and the army of Israel. What better example than the entire army of Israel, with Saul, the biggest man that they had, strongest, most capable physically, most capable physically. And you hear this young boy of 17 comes in without fear. You think he must be foolish or crazy or something. But in actual fact, we're told that the reason he had no fear was because he had absolute faith that somehow God would succeed. It's an amazing witness. It's a lesson, I think, that faith can drive away fear. Great faith can dispel great fear. And that's what we need to do. It's like somebody once said, being able to face your own Goliath, essentially. Each of these fears that we have is almost like our own Goliath. We have to be able to face up to them, knowing that God is going to be able to overcome in the end. So I hope that was somewhat helpful. It helps me, if nothing else, understand the process a little bit. And the end result, hopefully, is that at the conclusion of the whole matter, in regards to this one particular emotion, and hopefully might get a chance to look at another few down the road, is this, from Ecclesiastes 12 and 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, reverence God, and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. So, thank you.